And right now, into the politics, and our commentators today are Neil Jones and Bridget Morton. Good morning, both.
Morning. Morning.
Neil Jones was Chief of Staff to the Labor leader Jacinda Ardern, and prior to that was Chief of Staff to Andrew Little. He is Director of Capital Government Relations, and he does declare an interest when we are talking about COVID and other matters. He has a personal connection working in the Minister's office. Bridget Morton is a Senior Consultant with public and commercial law firm Franks and Ogilvie, a former Senior Ministerial Advisor for the previous National Government, and she declares an interest for today's topics anyway, that she worked on the local election campaign for Nicola Willis in Wellington Central. Yes? Handing out pamphlets and other things. Good morning, both of you. Right, COVID, the lockdown again. So soon after one was lifted after 3 days with questions being asked. There's a sense, and this is particularly coming from Auckland, there's a sort of a sense of fatigue hitting. Is the whole cooperation holding together? Is the whole messaging holding together? There's a sense that this is a bit of a pivotal moment. Do you want to kick off, please?
Yeah, it definitely feels like the be kind message has, you know, had its day, and that we're really switching more into now people wanting to see others playing their part. And you can see there's a lot of blame around South Auckland, but there's also a lot of people going constructively, what should have the government done better here? You know, key things like, did they deliver the message about what people needed to be doing in the right way? And I had seen someone say that there's up to about 100 different languages spoken in the South Auckland community. Were they down in those grassroots communities, speaking to community leaders and making sure that message was out? And then secondly, making sure that people were aware of what their rights were or what support they could get if they didn't go to work. You know, I feel like I'm in an incredibly privileged position to say it's easy for me not to come to work. It'd be easy for me not to have been, you know, done this from home rather than be in the studio today. But that choice is really different for a lot of different people, you know, for people with, you know, more frontline jobs that don't necessarily know that the support's out there. So whilst, yes, definitely the temper has changed, I also think the government is really on the hop on this one.
Look, it's easy to speak with the benefit of hindsight. I'm sure now they are asking themselves, was the 3 days long enough? Not because theoretically they didn't have it under control. They knew who was linked to whom, and they'd given instructions for affected parties to stay at home. But because that depended on absolutely everybody doing exactly what they were asked to do in this instance. A more conservative move that may have clearly would have hurt businesses longer, but may have had a different outcome, would have been to stay in lockdown. Is that going to be the subject of a lot of scrutiny this coming week?
I think absolutely. I mean, it's always a calculated risk about when they come in and out of lockdowns. And they did make the determination, as the Prime Minister has said, on the basis that they believed everyone was cooperating and that they had the contact tracing systems, etc. But I was reflecting this morning, though, you know, you had the calls from National saying, well, why weren't these people that were self-isolating, why weren't they not being checked up on, why were they not, you know, making sure that they were following the rules, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost exactly the same conversation we're having this time last year when people were coming back from overseas and the questions were being asked, why was nobody checking on people in their homes to make sure they were self-quarantining?
You can't check on thousands and thousands.
No, but they were checked on once a day
by the Ministry of Health.
The bigger issue, I think, and this pertains to the earlier case, which is now linked to the latest case, which is the one of considerable concern because of the amount of places this person's been, was that the family weren't tested on a particular day and had been hard to contact. And that's when people are saying, OK, when do you go and knock on doors? Haven't been able to reach you by phone, but go and knock on doors. Now, at one level, it sounds like nitpicking. At the other, it's the last line of defence. And again, is that going to be the subject of how much resource, especially in a diverse community with, as we said, a lot of different languages, can't just presume they're all sitting watching the 1 o'clock, you know, briefings or the 9 p.m. briefings on a Saturday night? Is it granular enough?
Well, I think it's a consequence of the success here we've had with COVID, in that we have to be nitpicky because it's very quickly, you can see it overseas, how quickly you can go from a small outbreak like this to a much bigger community one. So we rely on our officials being nitpicky and being quite well, being robust, not quite robust, robust in terms of what they are doing to make sure that A, the message is out there, and B, that people have understood it and are complying with it. And I can completely understand. I think, you know, Chris Bishop this morning on Morning Report was so articulate in saying really clearly that people are sick of this sort of be kind, we're a team of 5 billion rhetoric. We actually need to be much more coming down on people for individual responsibility.
That can backfire, though. And look, when you think about young people and when a high school is involved, it's going to be young people. The last thing you want is people hiding. You want them telling you everything. We learnt some more tomorrow, this morning, about a matter that had not been disclosed, a connection between two families that had not been disclosed. You don't want, especially with young people, that natural instinct to just hide and pretend
that,
it's not
that, that is the risk. And I mean, my gut sympathy is, you know, throw the book at them. But I also know that if you have a situation where people worry they're going to face charges or fines or even have their name out in public humiliation for coming forward, that's the worst possible scenario. Because rather than finding out these breaches happen, the worst situation is we don't find out they happen. And so we end up just with undetected community spread. So I think it makes for good populist politics, and it chimes with our gut reaction when we hear about these things to say throw the book. I just think we've got to be a bit careful there. I would also say on the question of should we have stayed in lockdown, look, when the government did the 3-day lockdown recently, the call there from a lot of people was this is an overreaction. Now we're to believe that we were supposed to have 13 days more in lockdown at a time when the government believed, based on the advice and all the evidence they had, that there was a perimeter around it. The only cases we were getting in the community were already in isolation. There were tens of thousands of tests done. There was wastewater sampling and subsampling. And the idea that the public would have tolerated 13 more days of lockdown with zero new positives out in the community coming in is just farcical. You would risk a complete breakdown in social license. People would just start defying it. It is not even a viable option.
It happened last year. We went right through to have the two cycles. Remember, we had to do the 14 days,
yes, but,
absolutely
but,
clear.
But that was when we had an absolutely uncontrolled outbreak all across New Zealand. This was a case where we've done it as a country before, where you have an incursion, you have a group of people who have been infected, and you isolate them, you isolate their contacts, you trace, you test, and you get it under control. And we've done that before. What they didn't count on was people breaking the rules. And I think there is a point here to be said that I think where we do need to look at this is how disconnected I think some of these communities are. So I think a lot of them, they don't feel able, or they're not aware of their rights at work. They don't necessarily get their news. They're probably not listening to, 9 to noon politics right now. So there is a challenge there. And I think we need to constantly be looking at that. How do we reach these people? But also I think, you know, it's important that there is scrutiny, because the way a democracy works and why they're strong is governments face blowback when things go wrong and they get tested and then they have to improve and stop things going wrong. But we also have to be careful we keep it in perspective. This is a virus that has ravaged countries all around the world. We are one of the very few countries that actually has got it under control. And it's not, you know, I think, yes, we should be asking questions about which, you know, the health officials and how do they trace and what doors they knock on and when. But let's not pretend that this is just some simple thing that we just paint by numbers and it'll work.
Nobody's suggesting that. In fact, I think since the Bridges' departure from, and it, you know, quite possibly cost him his leadership, National has hit the right tone in raising questions and doing it in a way that makes it sounds like it is on board and actually wants success and not failure with these things. So I think people are genuinely and generally following that approach, right? There's no perfect answer to this. The question will be if this gets bigger. And the other matter that is lurking in the background is, yes, we've started vaccinating border workers and essential workers, but it is still looking like, unless the government can somehow bring forward some of its expected timeline of deliveries, it is still looking like the second half of this year till we get general vaccination. It sounds like everybody is now saying, let's vaccinate South Auckland first, which was the call of many on Friday, community leaders in particular. But it's still 3 months, Bridget. That is a long time to keep managing this situation.
Yeah, and that's why we have to keep up this constant pressure to make sure our border is as secure as we possibly can make it. You can never make it completely and utterly secure. But you've got to keep this pressure on. And I think you're absolutely right. I think National's narrative and the points that are constructive in the last sort of 10 days you've really seen that, they are making those points that we need to keep that pressure on government, because these are the types of things that we do need to be doing. We do need to be looking at what Taiwan's doing and making sure that we are doing best practice here and what else we could be doing.
ACT has also probably been a little bit more aggressive, but then it can always afford to be a little bit more aggressive because it's not necessarily playing for the big centre. All right. There's the question of communication then, particularly with the communities that keep being affected by this. We need to keep saying this. They're wearing this. There is the question of communication and whether that is good enough and reaching every single corner, every single household it needs to, right? The other question is the financial imperative in some of these households as well. Do you believe the government has got it right in making sure someone doesn't have to go to work? Someone, say, who might be a contractor and not going to get paid if they don't go to work. Does there need to be an extra effort?
Well, I mean, clearly. I mean, there is assistance there available. I think the question is, A, is it enough? And B, are they aware of it? And C, are their employers on board? Because one of the problems we face in our de-unionised economy is that workers don't have the power and the backing that they always had to demand their rights in the workplace. So I think there are a few challenges there that the government does need to probably have another look at and make sure they're getting it right. Having said that, as well as recognising this, and that's usually the point I start from, there is a basic personal responsibility as well, which is that you have to be living under a rock to not know that there is a thing called COVID-19, and if you're expressing symptoms of COVID-19, you probably shouldn't be going to work. So I think there's a bit of a mix there.
All right. So we wait and see. I think the mood shift is one that the government needs to be very aware of, and the sheer fatigue in Auckland in particular, which is, repeatedly going into this situation, and the frayed nerves. Like, for people, are literally people trying to organise lives, organise businesses, the nerves are sort of fraying. So it'll be very interesting to see whether the way this has been communicated successfully for a year holds another 3 months at least.
And that's the thing to remember, I think. We are looking at the finish line. I think we do have to remember that.
We're
looking at the beginning of the end of the finish line.
I'd love to be that confident.
No, what I mean to say is it's not like we're just staring at the start of this pandemic and we didn't know how long it would be going. There is a vaccine rollout coming second half of this year. We just have to hold it together a bit longer.
Okay. Let's see if that message is going to hold for another few months.
Well, let's hope it does.
All right. Let's look into some of the matters before Saturday night that we were looking into. And one of the big statistical reports that came out last week that probably got some but not a whole lot of coverage relates to one of the Prime Minister's stated priorities, which is the child poverty statistics. She has very closely, pre-COVID certainly, very closely married her brand to child poverty. What did you make of what was reported then, and especially in the context that things are likely to get worse on inequality and on poverty as a result of COVID? What did you make of the story told by those statistics?
Well, I think my analysis comes from is looking at what the people who also have built their brand or built, their analysis on poverty and countering poverty, and nobody I saw within that sort of advocacy community had anything positive really to say about those statistics. I think they were really realistic about, whilst there was some downward trends and that was going in the right direction, that because these statistics covered a pre-COVID period, they didn't really reflect what was happening in the community, and regardless of that, they still weren't good enough, nor were the measures taken by government good enough. So I don't think the Prime Minister got anywhere near achieving the sort of expectations that she set when she came into office on this issue.
Look, I'm of the view that as long as there is a single child in poverty, it's a failure and we need to address it. But I think we have to recognise 20,000 kids out of material hardship is an achievement. That's a good thing. It's the first time I think we've had anything of that nature since about the introduction of Working for Families. So that should be praised. I do think, though, it is a long way from where we need to be. And as you say, there are a lot of unknowns. On the one hand, you have the impact of COVID, which will likely hit people who are poorer harder. There is the complete runaway housing crisis in the last year. But on the other hand, we have had things like the increase in benefit levels, the winter energy payment, abatement thresholds. There have been some other measures as well. I think the key thing actually is just we know that poverty, that the benefits are well below what people need to live on. None of that changes based on the last year. And I think the budget coming up is an opportunity for the government to lift benefit levels significantly. And I think it probably is the best opportunity a Labor government will probably have in my lifetime to do that.
Yeah, so I agree with you on that, that the budget, I think, will be a really key player in seeing what they're willing to sort of target with this. Because one of the issues they've got from a narrative point of view is that Grant Robinson is, you know, parading out there that the economy has done very well despite COVID. You know, unemployment is not as high as everyone thought it would be. But that means that they've got to turn that into actual action on the portfolio areas that they say that they are focused on.
One of the challenges for Jacinda Ardern is that part of her communication style is that cut through that has impact. You know, climate change is this country's nuclear-free moment. The problem is that sounds good and inspirational in an election campaign. We know the size of the challenge that you then have to deliver on as a Prime Minister. Now, is that, in some ways, this sounds callous, the politically the corner she's painted herself into with child poverty, because people are going to measure by those statistics, and very likely by the time of the next election, those statistics will not have improved substantially and may well be going backwards.
Yeah, which means she has to take action on this area. She has to show she's doing something, and doing, I think, something quite, you know, it can't be small measures. The sort of giving every preschooler a toothbrush, I think, announcement last week is not going to cut it. It has to be, I think, if she's going to get anywhere near trying to win that narrative and get anywhere near those expectations, she has to do what Neil has said and make some changes around welfare.
And the reality is the only real way to get people in real poverty out of poverty is to give them money. And so for people in work, there's been a huge amount done on the minimum wage. That's risen significantly, despite calls from the right to constantly not raise it. And I think when it comes to benefits, just, you know, we're going to need some political maturity here, because it is a very difficult issue politically. And I think, remember when Labor raised it at $25 at the start of COVID, Simon Bridges completely lost the plot and screamed about it in Parliament and was actually quite nasty. And I think we need the National Party as well, if Labor is going to move on this, to be mature about it.
Well, it was the last National government that did raise benefits. So I think we should keep that in mind, that it is not necessarily going to always be a left-right issue. I think people are, and it's one of the privileges we have about being in New Zealand, that it's centrist parties for the most part, and they are much more constructive and nuanced about this discussion than, you know, even if you look across the Tasman and Australia.
And I hope you're right, because I think I actually genuinely believe that the only way we're ever going to fix this toxic problem of poverty and prejudice against beneficiaries is if both parties realise we have to do something about it.
There's another problem. It's that even if you increase the benefit by the amount recommended by the Working Group on Poverty, I think it was something like a 40% increase to basic benefit levels over a period of time, the cost of housing and the cost of rentals will have outpaced that before you've even announced it. So this brings into their other big issue still, housing. A couple of moves to note last week. The Reserve Bank said, basically, don't send us a letter telling us to take housing into account when we are setting our and making our decisions, because it's going to lead potentially to some very difficult trade-offs. Minister sent a letter last week saying, please take housing into account when you... The status of this, when compared to their primary responsibility, their primary instruction, which is to keep inflation within a certain band, and then secondarily to do so while considering giving mind to full employment, I don't know what the status of housing is relative to those two. Business editor was telling us it comes third. But how do you deal with a desire for full employment at the same time as bringing house prices under control? Well, they are diametrically opposed monetary policy.
It won't have any impact on the OCR. And, I mean, if you look into the detail, which I did painstakingly over the weekend, when you look into it, this is actually a outcome that needs to be considered. So inflation and employment remain the primary objectives, and housing, they have to just show how they've considered it. That means, in reality, nothing. Adrian Orr came out in a speech and said it basically doesn't have an impact. What will be interesting is Robertson is requiring them to look at other measures around financial stability. So that's things like debt-to-income ratios and interest-only mortgages. And I think if the bank could do something on that, that might actually have an impact on dampening down investor demand, which could have some impact on housing prices.
The other matter that is clear is that they are talking about, the government, a demand-side package. At least it was a demand-side package when they were talking about it, ahead of the budget, as I understand, or at least signalled ahead of the budget. We thought that might be announced later in February. It's now been delayed a bit. I think the Minister said last week, we need to get this right. We have to consider renters. Straight away again, if you remove things that provide or provide extra costs to landlords, for example, ability to deduct interest or other costs, what do you think the landlord is going to do in response? And are they possibly in a situation, Bridget, where you know, they're putting something in this basket on the one hand and then being told what the impact will be and taking it out again? Again, if they are they at risk of painting themselves into a corner on expectations?
Well, I think everyone has expectations that the government does something, and that, you know, I was quite surprised, I have to say, that, you know, everyone raised expectations that there'd be a package sort of announced sort of mid-February, and originally a three-day lockdown pushed that to mid to late March. It basically told me that they didn't have a plan,
The minister last week said, we are taking time to do this properly because we also have to consider the impact on renters.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that if anything last year told us is that we can't take any more time on this. You know, I think they probably thought, what a lot of people did, that COVID and lockdown may, you know, take some of the heat out of this market and mean that the government intervention was not so needed. It's no doubt since the election that it has been needed. And so it's a little bit concerning about why this is taking so much time for them to say something, because it is building up expectation more and more and more. And you just get another daily media report of how much prices have gone up.
It depends what they do. The extension to the Brightline test, and I'm a little confused on this and I've never been able to clarify it, as to whether it would only apply to and properties that are sold from now on. Because if that is the case, then you might avoid having someone who's got a property and owned a property from 8 years saying, I'll hang on to it for another 2 years. All that's going to do is worsen the supply side, right? So the extension to the Brightline test, I think everybody is saying, is a likely thing if it happens on that basis. It's a question if they go and do other things that reduce the attraction of investment properties. If you did them, you may well shock the market into releasing a lot of properties. But the other response may be, we're yanking up rents.
Yeah, look, I think the key point here is that there is no silver bullet in the housing crisis. So it will be a whole range of measures across a decade that will actually fix this. The Brightline test seems to be the one they're talking about. I don't really buy the argument that it'll put rents up. I think rents do not reflect the actual costs. They are, it's supply and demand, and it's what they can demand. And the reason rents are rising so high is not because it's costing landlords more. You know, rents haven't doubled in Newtown and Wellington in recent years because suddenly the cost of having a rental's increased. It's because they can charge more because there aren't enough houses. So I actually think sucking a bit of investor demand out will be a good thing that will help stop some of the speculation. I think between the
But you want properties coming to market
exactly.
So that people can buy them.
So I think
you don't want people going, okay, I'll hang on another X number of years before I sell this.
Yeah, and so that is a design issue that they have to look at. I mean, I'd just do a Brightline test forever, personally, which is a capital gains tax on anything but the family home. That is the obvious thing to do. And it looks like we're just going to slowly get there over a period of years by default, by governments continually just lobbing years onto the end of it.
Another story last week was the, well, there were two actually, let's stay with housing, cracking week for National on Housing, with the particular program, many hundred million dollars it costs and 12 families so far supplied. It's a complicated program. It's about getting people who would never be able to probably get themselves into their own home, Was it a case of sometimes it's best to say nothing? I think Nicola Willis was the MP who dug up or asked in a select committee how many houses have been sold under this program. Would have it been better for the government just to answer and then stay stum?
Yeah, I think there was some definite political mismanagement of the progressive home ownership. It was absolutely right, Nicola Willis coming out, doing that, you know, actually what you expect of
an opposition
and research to see how many people, because this is a program that was first, you know, promised under the coalition agreement with the Greens in 2017. It was only launched, I think, July last year or something. So you can see why there's obviously a lag. But obviously, in terms of the current market, this is the type of things that you would expect there to be more, action on. What was really bizarre was that, you know, advertising video from Megan Woods, who is normally a very astute minister who's well known for getting things done, so, you know, parading that 12 was somehow, you know, a really big achievement. It was just out of step with what community expectation is at this time on housing. It was, it was very unusual.
Yeah, I think the negativity around that flowed from a general dissatisfaction that not enough to be done on housing. And look, Nicola Willis, good on her. She's run some good opposition
yeah.
politics. On an issue where National does have a credibility issue, and I think she's managed to turn that quite effectively on the government.
3 years ago now, you're a long way from being able to go, you guys.
I think the thing with the progressive home ownership policy, though, is that it is a policy that takes 2 to 3 years to get in. That's what the cabinet paper. It is important. We're discussing.
Explaining
that.
Is losing, Neil, and that's why you don't put out a video.
I'm not defending that. I'm just saying, you know, the actual policy.
Yeah.
Is.
So say that and move on. Don't put out your video.
Well, no, I agree. But it is important because it is a program that takes 2 to 3 years to have an impact. It's about taking people who have, you know, bad debt, who have savings issues. It's actually hitting its targets.
Right. But it still comes out as 12 families. The next good hit that Nicola Willis had was to do with state houses and the amount of state houses that the government has purchased, right, that are existing houses. So they're not adding to the overall housing stock. This is Kāinga Ora purchasing these houses. They are buying houses in the existing housing stock. Now, you can't double count that. You can't say we've got X number of new state houses if some of them have been taken out of the private market. Another good hit.
Absolutely. And I think also that underlying that wasn't necessarily reported as well as just how many public housing that's actually selling. Because, and for legitimate reasons, that obviously you're selling off stock that doesn't meet what you actually need to supply, which is exactly what National did as well. And
there is a fundamental difference. National had a program of selling down the stock, whereas what Labor is doing is what every government has even done. I'm sure Michael Joseph Savage did this, which is occasionally there is the odd house which isn't fit for purpose,
sure.
and you sell it and you reinvest it.
Yes, but that's not what Labor has told people. Labor has been very...
I was there when the policy was being written in opposition, and it always said...
In
that
the last
that
three
houses
years,
are...
Labor has hit National for selling down stock while doing it.
Yes, because National left with fewer state houses than they started with. This is a completely dishonest conflation from National to hide their shameful record selling state houses.
Well, I think this debate tells you one thing, is that there is two... You know, this is a complex issue and this
no,
story
it's not
is being
complex.
Told.
It's not complex at all. National is just being dishonest. They had a deliberate program.
The thing is that I would say that Labor is being dishonest on this because they not say that they were selling
Labor
down while
always,
hitting National
they,
saying
they're
they
not selling
down
the stock. National had a deliberate program of moving stock out of the state, out of the state's purview,
okay.
and reducing the state housing stock.
The point is you cannot double count at a time when you've now got 20, is it 22,000 people on a state housing list, and that's going to keep getting worse for the conversation we've just been having. You can't be buying existing houses out of the existing New Zealand housing market and then saying we've added X number of new state houses because the overall stock for houses people live in has not increased.
Yeah.
So that is good opposition work to be
I think it does help to reduce some of the Labor being able to say how many houses they've built. The reality is when the government changed, the public service did not know how to build houses. It had been completely gutted. And if you look at the stats, when National was in power, when they bought new houses, really, they bought at a much higher level than they built. Under this government, they have started reducing it. At the beginning of the term, they had to buy a higher amount. Now they're ramping up the building.
This is a great advertisement for why Kiwi Build failed. You can't defend that what the government has done over the last 3 years
on public housing, they've actually ramped up the build quite significantly.
I know, but it's still not keeping up. But the point is, it is good opposition work to point out, don't be trying to make it look like you've got this new houses when in fact some of them have been taken out of the existing housing pool.
I think it is good opposition work.
It is keeping people on their toes.
No, it is good opposition work. I just think we do have to sometimes refer back to the
All
facts.
All right. Okay. Some of that was facts. Some of the lease was facts. Some of it's disputed. Simon Bridges and our Wokes to Police... Our Wokester Police Commissioner, I actually listened in to the key part of the conversation on the Select Committee, and there was some robust questioning.
Yeah.
And I think Simon Bridges is tapping into something that is a sleeper, and that is how incredibly frustrated communities are and how much more frustrated they're going to get over gang activity in many places and right under the noses of, you know, the good citizens, if I can put it that way, right? Mm. It is shameless. There are guns involved. There are shootings in the middle of places, you know, popular places in Napier. We're not talking this... how can I put this? There's a sense in many towns and cities that it is getting out of control, right? Is he setting a trap somehow? Is he beginning... He got a headline by calling the police commissioner Wokester, but is he actually setting a trap by digging into a sleeper issue that is going to take off?
I think it is a good issue for National. It's one that has the potential to get cut through. I think it does reflect real concerns in communities. I don't think Nationals' answers are necessarily going to fix the problem, but I think it is, for an opposition politician, it's a very good, fertile area to run on. And it's one the government has to make sure they're addressing and have a better story on. I think the problem for Bridges is that he's not actually the police spokesperson, and he ended up getting lost in this. And whether
but
that
no
was
one deliberate. Cares about that. The
well, people, no, they do.
All people heard was Wokes to police commissioner.
No, they
and
do. They do
up.
Because there was a whole media cycle that followed of him rebuking Judith Collins and saying, "Well, she can't reprimand me because she's not my wife." And it actually created a news cycle. Which, look, I remember working in Labour and opposition during the dark times. This was a movie I've seen before. It doesn't actually matter if people don't think you can govern yourselves. Then they don't think you can govern the country. And it did highlight all of the weaknesses of a weak leadership and a weak party.
Right.
And there is an argument to be made, and Richard Harman's piece said that the National Caucus believes widely that Bridges is trying to set up Luxon for the leadership. This is classic because when you're doing
how is Bridges setting up Luxon for the leadership by calling the police commissioner Wokester?
Because what happens, and I've seen this film before. I've been part of it. What happens is the party looks weak, right? The leader looks weak because she can't control her caucus. From any analysis, it's not a good thing to happen. But it actually, by creating that disorder, you open up a breach for someone else to come in.
Okay.
So the incentives are misaligned.
That said, it is possibly a really good sleeper issue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it talks to the base. And I actually...
Do you think he was stirring either to get his own profile up again? Does he have some kind of ambitions of a comeback? And is this part of it in the first instance?
I think he's got no doubt that there's ambitions for him to succeed. He wants to, you know, he wants to have his name out there. But also I think, you know, it's smart politics. Judith Collins has been really clear about the fact that she doesn't want that one-dimensional personality trait of being Crusher Collins. Therefore, as Stephen Mills was saying last week, you've got to differentiate that you don't have your leader necessarily always being the one that makes the negative hits. And also particularly when it's a hit like this that is quite, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric, you know, calling him Wokester, you know, all of that sort of stuff is perfect that you want your spokesperson to do. And Simon Bridges, being an ex-Crown prosecutor, you know, he's got that background. He is, you know, he's out of central casting for all this argument.
He set it off, but also, that was the reason I went and listened to the Select Committee.
Can I just say though, Bridget, that would be a very credible story. Very credible story. Well, if not the fact that the next day it was Collins trying to reprimand him and him saying, "You're not my wife, you can't reprimand me." I'm not sure that's part of the setup.
You're never going to put Bridges in a corner.
Yeah, no.
To misquote a film.
So, I mean, I think that kind of thing, if choreographed well, can work, but it clearly wasn't choreographed.
I still wonder whether it is a matter that is going to become a feature of the next election campaign. And look, I was talking to a senior police officer a year ago on the show who used the phrase, "We cannot arrest our way out of this." Some of it is directly linked to a rise in new gang numbers, and again, explaining is losing. You can say we don't know how many people have fallen out of those gangs, or we've successfully moved out of those gangs. We don't know what the numbers are. But there is no doubt that there is a heavy recruitment going on. All police will tell you that. And a different, brasher, bolder kind of gang marketing going on right now. Couple that with guns, and you are going to end up with a real weeping sore ahead of the next election. And like all these other problems, there's no obvious answer.
It also is one that kind of really... It's hard for a Jacinda Ardern-led government to really push back on, because that is not their brand to be tough on crime. You know, this is... the kind government, this is the, you know, the government that is does by cooperation and teamwork and all of that, that's their brand. So for them, for National, it's actually really good cut through because it's something that that Labour can't. They can explain their way out with, you know, this policing program at this level, at this community, with this, etc. But it's never going to get the cut through that tough on crime issues are.
Thanks both of you very much. Bridget, I was going to call you Bridget Jones for a minute. I always do this.
She is the more famous Bridget.
I assure you we're not married.
No, I think of Bridget Jones, Bridget Jones' Diary.
I was thinking Bridget Jones' Diary. Neil thought I'd married you off. I've done that with Stephen before
as well. Yes, you married me to Stephen before.
Bridget Morton and Neil Jones, thank you.